Hello, everyone. Welcome to Lab Medicine's podcast series. My name is Kelly Swales, and I'm the web editor for Lab Medicine. Joining me today is Elizabeth Sullivan. She's an attorney with the McDonald Hopkins Law Firm, specializing in regulatory compliance and licensing matters in healthcare. She's going to talk with us today about some of the legal issues that pertain to pathologists and clinical laboratory scientists. Thanks for talking with us today, Ms. Sullivan.
Thanks, Kelly. My intent with this podcast is really to touch on some of the broad compliance topics that pathologists and laboratorians frequently encounter. So the topics in this podcast are going to include state licensure issues for pathologists and labs, sales and marketing compliance considerations, what we're seeing with respect to payer audits, and also laboratory developed tests. Because we have a limited amount of time for the podcast today, this isn't going to be a comprehensive look at each of the topics, but what I'm hoping to do with this podcast is to provide you with an introduction that will help you analyze your own practices and operations with an eye towards compliance. I should also just note my legal disclaimer is that the information provided in this podcast is not intended to be legal advice, and the views expressed during the podcast are my own. So just to jump into the first topic that we are going to talk about on this podcast, that is state licensure considerations. And so this is interesting because in recent years, the avenues for delivering healthcare have become increasingly more diverse. I think this is probably true, and all providers recognize this. And it's either through the evolving structures of delivering healthcare or just basically the evolution of technology. So pathology and laboratory practices aren't any exception to this. And regardless of the drivers, it's become more common to transport specimens across state lines. And in the future, particularly for the practice of pathology, digital technologies may make it even easier to provide remote interpretations without the transport of specimens. And as all this innovation is happening, states are really becoming more sensitive to out-of-state providers rendering services to in-state patients. So it's really critical to be aware of the licensure requirements in any state from which you might be accepting specimens, whether that's on the pathologist's and physician licensure side or whether that's on the clinical laboratory side. So I'm going to talk a little bit about physician licensure requirements first. With respect to physician licensure requirements, my experience has been that there is generally sometimes a misconception by physicians that a consultation exception to state licensure exists as long as the physician that is engaging in the consultation remains in his or her home state when they're rendering the consult or the interpretation. In fact, there is no blanket peer-to-peer consultation exception. Whether a state requires state licensure is completely dependent on that state's law and the way that the state law is written. And that's based on where the patient is located, not where the physician is located. This means that there are 51, if you're counting the District of Columbia, and that doesn't even count territories, there are 51 different requirements that a physician or a pathologist generally needs to be aware of. A state may require the physician to have a medical license, and if not, the physician can be subject to disciplinary action for the unlicensed practice of medicine. So it is really critical to be aware of where you're accepting specimens from and what type of services you are actually providing. So telemedicine, you know, we are seeing obviously an explosion of telemedicine now within the healthcare industry, and it's bringing about some movement towards standardization through the Federation of State Medical Boards and a state licensure compact, but the developments are fairly new, and this is an area where the law is evolving on a very regular and very frequent basis. It's an area of flux, and state medical board position statements often modify what may or may not exist under the state statutes and regulations. So it's an area you really have to monitor. There are a couple broad categories for which state laws actually fall into. There are limited exceptions for consultations, and those limited exceptions have fairly clear requirements. There are states with no exceptions, and there are states with broader vague guidance with respect to their consultation exceptions. So I want to talk a little bit about the different consultation exceptions that are out there. The first is limited consultation exceptions. So although, you know, I just spent a little bit of time cautioning everyone about the framework that's out there with respect to licensure consultations, exceptions, and exceptions to licensure, many states do have peer-to-peer consultation exceptions. In fact, most states do. But the spirit of the exceptions is really about one physician calling an expert or an old colleague for input into that physician's own diagnosis. So most of these laws were put on the books way before, you know, technology advanced in the way that it has. So there just wasn't, you know, these sorts of instances simply were not part of what was contemplated when the laws were being put in place. So it's important to note that these exceptions don't permit a pathologist to discuss results directly with a patient or render a primary diagnosis. Instead, the pathologist's interaction really has to be limited to the pathologist licensed in the state that has requested the consultation. As a general matter, there can be some frequency limitations to these types of peer-to-peer consultation exceptions. For states that have limited consultation exceptions, they also will often limit the frequency of the consultations. While some states actually define the frequency or define the threshold, others simply have laws that use words like infrequent or irregular, and different states interpret those words differently. So for some states that have these limited consultation exceptions, that may mean 6 in a given year, while other states, it may mean as many as 24 in a year. And those are both outliers. Most states don't define infrequent or irregular, and I think 24 generally would be many for many of these states. So the next category of states are states that actually prohibit consultation by an out-of-state professional that isn't holding a license in that state. These are states that have no broad exception that permits an out-of-state consultation. And these states really are in the minority. Frankly, most states do have a peer-to-peer consultation exception of sorts. But even though these states are in the minority, it's really important to obtain a current analysis of each state's law. Some states, the limited exceptions are defined in such a way that the exceptions really aren't practical, or it's hard to fit into them, so they really wouldn't be useful. So I suppose those states would also fall into this bucket. And the final bucket are states that may have a broad consultation exception to physician licensure, but their guidance is very vague, and there is very little to go on when you get into those states. These states are particularly challenging because you're trying to attempt how the state medical board would react in the event that a question is presented. And it's difficult to find guidance to rely on in these instances. And this is another area where it's really critical to monitor the state restrictions and look for new statutes or regulations. But also, in these particular states, it's critical to monitor the state medical board guidance, because as a pathologist, that is where you would be looking. You'd be looking at the medical board to see if they will give you any indication of what would be acceptable practice without a state license versus what they would take issue with. There are a couple other things to keep in mind when you are accepting specimens from another state. I'm not going to get into these in too much detail, but one of them is professional liability coverage. I think it's important to note that a number of insurers will only provide professional liability coverage in adjoining states or states in which you do have licensure. So that's something that is important, is to check your professional liability coverage with respect to any limitations about practicing outside the state in which you are located. Now I'm going to talk a little bit about laboratory licensure, which admittedly is more straightforward than the physician licensure issues with respect to consults. So here, what I really want to make everyone aware of is the fact that there are a number of states that require laboratories to have a state license in addition to the CLIA certificate that all labs have if they are accepting specimens. So there are not a ton of these states, but they do exist. The states that normally require an out-of-state laboratory to hold a license in order to accept specimens from that state can change, so certainly don't rely on this. But as of the date of this recording, those states are California, Florida, New York, Pennsylvania, Maryland, and Rhode Island. Those are the ones that we see most often, and those are the states that you'd want to be mindful of the state licensure requirements in the event that you're accepting specimens from those states. In addition, there are some states that have other rules relating to collection stations. So if, for example, you were collecting specimens in a state and then bringing them back to your laboratory, and your employees were actually performing the collections, or, you know, it was somebody that you had contracted with, you could potentially have an issue there. The state of New Jersey is an example of this. So while New Jersey does not require an out-of-state laboratory to have a New Jersey state laboratory license to test specimens from the state of New Jersey, if you're entering the state to collect specimens, then New Jersey requires you to have a license. And again, this is all as of the date of this recording. A couple other considerations, and this would be true for laboratory licensure as well as providing professional services across state lines. Contractual language and state tax considerations are also, you know, critical when you're evaluating entering another jurisdiction. So you may be entering into a service contract that has language around what licensure you are required to maintain. And of course, by performing services or potentially being deemed to be performing services in another state, that may also carry state tax consequences. So these are things that you want to be aware of as you are evaluating your business plan and looking at your footprint and potentially expanding into other state jurisdictions. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about sales and marketing compliance considerations. And this is an area where we see many questions from our clients. There's a framework for federal, state fraud and abuse regulations that labs and pathology groups and all healthcare providers have to be aware of when they are marketing services to customers or to potential customers. Obviously, the industry is very competitive, and that only raises the compliance stakes. So I want to talk a little bit about sort of the most relevant federal restrictions, and those are probably ones that are familiar to you, the Medicare and Medicaid anti-kickback statute and the Stark Law. And the Stark Law is sometimes referred to as the physician self-referral law. So the anti-kickback statute applies to any person, and it is intended to prohibit, in fact, it does prohibit, the knowing and willful solicitation, offer, payment, or receipt of any remuneration, whether that remuneration is direct or indirect, in return for referrals or items or services covered by a government program. The violations of the anti-kickback statute are punishable by civil monetary penalties, criminal penalties, and exclusion from the Medicare and Medicaid programs. And the thing to remember with respect to the anti-kickback statute is that it applies to any person. So it is not specific to healthcare providers. And this is a place where you see, you know, compliance concerns with respect to a sales and marketing force, or other individuals, you know, within an office or within an entity. So something else that labs and pathology groups are often wrestling with is the provision of free services to a referral source. And this is normally taking the form of a phlebotomist or a collector. And as you can imagine from this segment, the provision of these types of services can also implicate the fraud and abuse laws on a federal level as well as a state level. The provision of a phlebotomist or a collector in a physician office or another referral source's clinic can violate the anti-kickback statute if that individual is performing services that are not directly related to the collection or processing of specimens for the laboratory provider. So if the individual ends up doing anything else like filing or answering telephones or other clerical functions or medical functions, Stark law and anti-kickback could be violated by both parties unless the referral source is paying fair market value for those other services. So if you place a phlebotomist or a specimen collector in a physician's office, it's important to have a written agreement with the referral source memorializing the understanding of what that individual is going to be doing. And it should specifically set forth, you know, the limitations on the individual as well as what the individual will be doing. I also always think it's a good idea and recommend that you have a written agreement with the collector so that it is also clear that that individual understands the requirements and limitations of the individual's post. Because, you know, obviously when you have a collector that might be placed in another office, they come to feel like they are part of that office. That is where they're reporting on a regular basis. You know, if everybody else is overworked and they're sort of waiting for the next patient to come in to collect a specimen, they might feel guilty or they might want to help out. But that is problematic for both parties. So it's really critical that all of the parties involved understand, you know, these limitations and don't cross that line. The other thing I would note about free services is that there are a few states that actually limit or prohibit pathology providers and laboratories from providing collectors and phlebotomists to a referring physician. Two of those states that, as of this recording, are Florida and Pennsylvania, so that's certainly something to keep in mind. If you're going to be placing these types of collectors, you need to give due consideration to the federal and state fraud and abuse laws, and you also want to check state law to see if there's any specific limitations on placing someone in an office. Something else that is sort of related and frankly is the inverse of what we just talked about is payment for collection services, where you would have a laboratory or a path group that is paying the referral source for the referral source's collection of the specimens. This is a recent trend that we've seen, and I have had situations where clients have had physician offices that actually ask about this, or clinics or other referral sources that will actually ask. And these types of arrangements present really serious compliance risks for both parties. And in fact, the OIG actually issued a special fraud alert on the topic in 2014, specifically addressing these types of arrangements, and basically saying that they found them particularly problematic, and really what it signaled is that there would be heavy scrutiny with any types of these arrangements. So while the guidance has not made the arrangements per se illegal, they are heavily scrutinized and they have to be very carefully structured. And it's also worth noting that there are state laws that actually prohibit pathologists and laboratories from paying physicians for specimen collection. So it's a type of practice that, you know, there may be a way to do it compliantly and it may be acceptable in certain jurisdictions, but it is certainly a very risky area and it has to be very carefully constructed and carefully monitored. So the final thing that I want to talk about briefly before we move away from sales and marketing compliance considerations is account billing. And I know this is something that is certainly, you know, many, many pathology groups and clinical laboratories are wrestling with this. Because where it is permitted, it's not uncommon for physicians to request these types of arrangements. And frankly, it's not uncommon for physicians and laboratories to create account billing arrangements. So these are arrangements where basically the physician purchases the services and typically marks up the price and then rebills those services for patients and payers. These arrangements, while they are common currently in states where they are permitted, they do potentially implicate Stark and anti-kickback because of the benefit that is being provided to the referring physicians. So there's generally a concern that if the laboratory provider or the pathology group that's providing the services provides those services at a discount to the physician so that the physician can turn around and bill separately and mark up the price on those specimens, then the physician is realizing that value and that could potentially be influencing their choice of provider. And that is what the government is concerned about. And that is problematic under Stark and anti-kickback. In addition, for those of you that are familiar with this and potentially navigating this space currently, there are many states that actually have limitations on these types of arrangements. Some states actually prohibit the arrangements Other states require the physician to disclose the arrangement and the pricing and the markup, and still other states actually prohibit the physician from marking up the cost of the services to their patients. And this is also true with respect to Medicare patients. Medicare does have an anti-markup prohibition. So this is account billing generally, that's going to be a discussion you're having relating to commercial work and commercial payers. But even on the commercial side, from a state law standpoint, you may have prohibitions and it may be impermissible. I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about payer audits, because that is certainly something that we are seeing an increase in our payer audits, both on the government side from Medicare and even in some instances Medicaid, and also on the commercial side. So we're seeing it in private payer side as well. The number of these audits are really increasing. They've increased very sharply in recent years. And we're not only seeing a, you know, increase in the number of these types of audits, but we're also seeing an increase in the level of intensity in which the payers are sort of, you know, pursuing these overpayments from lab and pathology providers. The failure to have or be able to provide, frankly, proper documentation to payers can result in the need to repay amounts in the tens and hundreds of thousands. And we've actually had situations where clients have had a small number of claims, sometimes less than 100 claims, that have been extrapolated to overpayment demands that are in the millions. So it is definitely a space where payers are becoming increasingly more aggressive. In addition to just generally an increase in these audits, health insurers are now also scrutinizing how pathologists and laboratories handle out-of-network billing and including how they balance bill patients. So on the private side, you know, you could potentially get into a situation where they're auditing that or simply monitoring those practices, and that may even trigger an audit on its own. So on a basic level, there are three types of Medicare audits. The first is the comprehensive error rate testing audit, or CERT audit, and this is typically focused on those who provide high-cost items or services, have high volumes, or have atypical billing or coding practices. So those are the types of things that would trigger a CERT audit. Recovery audit contractor program audits, or RAC audits, certainly something that we've heard about in the news for quite some time, and those are performed by private contractors that are actually paid a percentage amount from the payments that they are able to discover and recover. So this is a situation where the private contractors actually have an incentive to find inappropriate payments. And the third type of audits, from a Medicare standpoint, are the Zone Program Integrity Contractor audits, or ZPIC audits. And these are the most serious. They are performed by contractors, and during these audits, the contractors actually mine the provider's data for compliance with Medicare coverage and coding policies. And in these instances, the ZPICs will also investigate fraud. They can potentially prepare cases for civil or criminal referrals to CMS or law enforcement agencies. Private payer audits are really less standard, and they're typically determined by your contract or the particular payer's handbook or policies and procedures, as well as being carried out in accordance with applicable law. And it's a little bit more difficult to categorize these audits because they can be very informal, or they could be formal. They can also be random, or they could be triggered by a particular practice. So when I mentioned, you know, sort of how are providers handling out-of-network billing or balance billing to patients, that might be something that would trigger a potential audit. In most instances, both on the government and the private payer side, the focus of audits is medical necessity in most instances. This really presents a challenge for labs and pathology groups, because third-party payers have very vague guidelines, if any, for determining what medical necessity is. And this is particularly true with respect to physicians and ordering clinicians. And in some ways, this is fair. And certainly providers question what role third-party payers should have in determining medical necessity. But regardless of this fact, we still continue to see these types of audits taking place. In particular, we're seeing them in the genetic testing and toxicology space. Those seem to be areas where payers, both on the government side and the private side, are focused. So regardless of the definition of medical necessity, it is a condition for coverage. So laboratory and pathology providers are stuck in these audit situations, being required, frankly, to document and provide evidence of medical necessity. There's basically three elements or three criteria applied with respect to medical necessity audits for laboratories and pathology groups. The first is an evidence of the order by an authorized provider. The second is documentation of the medical necessity. Again, this would be by the provider. And the third is usage of the test results. And of course, the only item that is applicable, or not applicable, but in the control of the laboratory or the pathologist, is the first, which is evidence of the order by an authorized provider. And even then, there may be challenges to obtaining that documentation as a practical matter. So one of the things that we often see and we wrestle with when we're dealing or assisting clients when they're dealing with audits is the fact that medical necessity, the documentation that they need, frankly, is usually out of their control, and they need to turn around and obtain it from the ordering providers. So typically for documentation, the payer is going to require the actual order by the treating physician or the authorized ordering provider. We've actually seen situations where the payer will assume that the services were not appropriately ordered if the documentation is not included in the laboratory's or the pathologist's pathology group's audit response. This required documentation with respect to the order can really vary by payer or by test or service, but in most instances, a signed requisition or a signed order is really ideal. So to the extent that these are things that you can implement a process on the front end to obtain and make sure you have in your file, that will protect you down the road and lessen the chance that you have to scramble to try and collect this documentation in the event of an audit. If you don't have that type of documentation, then oftentimes what you may need to do is try to request a signed attestation from the ordering physician, which may not be the easiest thing to obtain. This really is, as we're watching sort of the evolution of these payer audits, the requirement for medical necessity documentation has become a very significant challenge for many pathology groups and laboratories. The audits we're seeing will ask questions about test panels in toxicology, genetic, and molecular testing, and they'll also request the ordering physician to note why the service or test is medically necessary for diagnosis or treatment in the patient's medical record. So these are all things that through a laboratory or pathology audit that the labs or the pathology groups are being required to try and collect from their ordering providers in order to give to the payers. So an example of this is if you have a situation where a physician orders a genetic test, the payers are requiring documentation of what factors in the patient's medical condition, medical history, or family history led the physician to order such a test. And as you can imagine, or as you frankly know, this is not information that laboratories and pathology groups have ready access to. So it makes payer audits in the lab space particularly challenging. The other thing, as I've noted a few times above in this section, is payers are increasingly reviewing balance billing and routine waivers of copayments and deductibles during the audits. So this is another area where you want to be very sensitive to your current practices, and not only what is your policy with respect to your policies and procedures, but also what your marketing materials might say, or as a general practice, you know, what your customer service folks may be extending, you know, whether or not that creates a de facto policy even without a written policy. And I think it's worth noting here, and this is something that probably many of you are aware of, full waivers of copayments and deductibles are improper, and they're they're evidence of fraud to the government and, frankly, to commercial payers as well. This is something that you certainly want to review your policies and procedures and ensure that that is not a practice that is taking place. There are actually state prohibitions as well that exist that would prohibit the waiver of patient copayments and deductibles. So again, you know, you have your layered framework of the federal rules and regs and how they may impact your practice, as well as the state regulations, which you need to consider. So how to address all of this? You know, obviously, as I've been going through the audit, this section, you know, I've suggested some ways that you may be able to review your current practices and keep an eye on compliance. And really the best way to address these issues is preparation and periodic compliance training. And frankly, that is true of each of the sections that we've been discussing, but particularly here with respect to audits. You want to make sure that you have your documentation in line, and you want to make sure that the folks that are controlling the documentation are aware of the requirements so that they can document correctly and you aren't left scrambling when you do get a request for information in connection with an audit. So the next topic I want to talk about are laboratory developed tests. LDTs present interesting challenges for laboratories because both CMS through CLIA and the FDA have asserted oversight and frankly have oversight over LDTs. CMS regulates laboratories, as all of you know who are in this space, and it includes labs that are developing LDTs under CLIA. CLIA regulates the accreditation, inspection, and certification process of labs. And these regs, with respect to certification, also address the laboratory's ability to perform accurate and reliable testing. But one of the things that CLIA does not do, and the CLIA regs don't speak to, is evaluating test validation prior to marketing or assessing the clinical validity of an LDT. So even though the CLIA regs tell you how to go about validating, they don't actually assess the validation itself. FDA defines a laboratory developed test as an in vitro diagnostic test that is intended for clinical use and designed, manufactured, and used within one single laboratory. LDTs are often referred to as in-house developed or homebrew tests. These in vitro diagnostic devices are currently regulated as medical devices under the FDA. So as an LDT, the LDT is considered to be an in vitro diagnostic test, and therefore the FDA has the ability to oversee LDTs. The FDA evaluates and assures that the analytical and clinical validity of diagnostic tests, as well as the design, the manufacturing, the safety, and effectiveness of medical devices, is acceptable, and that is all done through the FDA's pre-market approval process. So this is something that has to happen before a device is actually taken to market. But what's interesting is that historically the FDA has taken the position that while it has authority to regulate LDTs, it has exercised enforcement discretion and has chosen not to exercise its enforcement over LDTs. And the reason for this historically is that LDTs have traditionally been relatively simple. And for the most part, they have been in labs, and the thought was that they would be, you know, reaching patients within that region, but they would not be, you know, nationwide tests that one laboratory is doing that could, you know, touch patients throughout the nation. Since things have changed and more laboratory-developed tests are being offered nationwide to a larger amount of patients, and they are more highly complex and may be addressing particularly critical diagnosis or conditions, the FDA has a renewed interest in LDTs and has certainly expressed interest in the past few years about exercising its oversight. I think it's worth noting with respect to LDTs, one of the other challenges is this concept of being completely developed in-house. So the FDA does not consider diagnostic devices designed or manufactured completely or partly outside of the laboratory to be an LDT. So this is a real challenge for labs who are taking various components and creating their own laboratory developed tests. Now, as a practical matter, you know, the FDA hasn't taken a lot of action against laboratories that are performing LDTs for tests that are not considered LDTs with respect to the FDA, but it's certainly something that has, you know, increased in the FDA's eyes and their attention. And it is actually something that they are looking more closely at and may be of more consequence in the future. Because the FDA takes the position that an LDT from start to finish has to be created and implemented in a single laboratory. And obviously this can become challenging. So there's been a great deal of discussion around the draft guidance that was issued by the FDA in October of 2014. And it indicated that the FDA was going to take a more hands-on approach to the evaluation of LDTs for all of the reasons that, you know, I just described. And since then, there has been a ton of speculation on both sides from parties of both interests as to whether or not the draft guidance was going to be formalized. And certainly there's been advocacy, again, on both sides, whether that draft guidance would be formalized by the FDA and the FDA would start enforcing its oversight, or whether the FDA would decide to abandon this activity. What is of interest, of course, and this actually came to light after this podcast was, the topics for this podcast were contemplated, was the fact that the FDA announced in November, after the election, that it was not going to release the final guidance on the regulation of LDTs. So it isn't clear at this point, you know, whether that existing framework proposed by the FDA is on hold, or if the new administration is going to impact the structure of the framework. So right now we don't know exactly what this means for FDA oversight of LDTs. Obviously, you know, the CLIA regs require or actually specify what a laboratory needs to do with respect to validating an LDT, but as far as the FDA's enforcement and oversight over LDTs, that remains to be seen what will happen there. And I think there are a lot of groups that are starting to try and, you know, sort of read the tea leaves and construct some expectations on what may happen next. But I would say certainly as of this recording, it is up in the air. And I think we will all, you know, be watching intently to see what happens next. Okay. I would just like to thank you all for the opportunity to cover some of these compliance topics. And I certainly encourage you that if you have questions or concerns, to certainly reach out to healthcare counsel that may be able to help you navigate these areas of compliance within the operation of clinical laboratories and the practice of pathology. Thank you very much.